Okay, so now we're going to move on to Kamala Shuler's talk. And I'm just going to do a brief introduction to him and to his talk. So I've been thinking about this theme of imagining the Buddha. And I've been thinking that one of the things about it is that we are, in a way, we're new Buddhists. We're not from a Buddhist culture. Yeah, we're first generation Buddhists, a lot of us. And in some ways that has certain disadvantages. We're not surrounded by a Buddhist culture. We have to try and create that for ourselves. That also has advantages as well. And one of the advantages of being a new Buddhist and trying to create a new Buddhist culture is that it, in a way, it makes you ask questions about the Buddhist tradition. It can bring in a certain freshness and questioning approach to the Buddhist tradition, which can be helpful and positive. Because you have to ask, well, why? Why do Buddhists do that? Why do they practice this particular thing? Why is it like that? It kind of encourages us maybe sometimes to get underneath the surface, down to the kind of principles, the underlying reasons for things. And in a way, that's been very much the approach of Tri Ratnam, the approach of Sangharakshita to the Dharma. Really just asking again and again, well, why did the Buddha teach that? Or how does that help human beings move towards enlightenment? And yeah, maybe we need to ask those kind of questions about the practices of Buddhism, about the cultural forms of Buddhism, and about the teachings of Buddhism. And maybe also we need to have that approach with the images and the myths and the symbols of Buddhism. We need to ask, yeah, what do they really mean? What are they really trying to communicate? And does that work for us in our culture? Or are there new ways eventually that are going to evolve which will communicate enlightenment to us in a way of relevant and meaningful to us? So in a way, yes, part of this theme of imagining the Buddha is in a way reimagining the Buddha, reimagining, trying to reconnect with the Buddha and find forms and myths and symbols which help us to do that. And in the Buddhist tradition, one of the images of enlightenment is the mandala of the five Buddhas. The mandala of the five Buddhas. So Buddhism obviously started with the Buddha Shakyamuni, gaining enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. But as Buddhist tradition went on, different Buddha figures emerged. So out of the uplifted imagination, the enlightened imagination of later practitioners, that image of the Buddha Shakyamuni started to take different forms. And enlightenment began to be expressed in different forms. And maybe different aspects of enlightenment, wisdom or compassion or fearlessness or generosity, was expressed through different Buddha forms. And one way this happened was through this image of the mandala of the five Buddhas, which are five different Buddhas, different colours, and they're arranged in a mandala, arranged in a kind of circle, where their different qualities are, yes, kind of related to each other through the way they're arranged in this mandala, in this circle. So that's one of the traditional symbols that's been handed down to us through the Buddhist tradition. And I think in this talk, there was a kind of evolution from the image of Shakyamuni Buddha to a more complex image of the mandala of the five Buddhas. And I think in this talk, Kamala Shuler is going to now go back the other way. He's going to be looking at the mandala of the historical Buddha, the mandala of Shakyamuni Buddha. So he's going to be looking at the teachings and practices of the Buddha, Shakyamuni, and looking at them as a kind of mandala, as a circle, and exploring the relationships between them and to each other. So yeah, we're lucky to have Kamala Shuler here to give us a talk. He's another long-standing member of our order, long-standing member of our community. He's a well-loved and respected figure, especially as a meditation teacher. He's written a book about meditation, which I'm going to say a little bit about later. He's also a public preceptor, and he's just involved in our community through many different ways. So yeah, let's give Kamala Shuler a good welcome, and he's going to talk to us about the mandala of the historical Buddha. Kamala Shuler.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for asking me to address this very special gathering. For asking me to say something about the Buddha, the historical Buddha Gautama, who was known in his time, I'm not quite sure, certainly after his time, as Shakyamuni, the silent sage of the Shakya clan. And I've never had much of a problem with the name Shakyamuni. In fact, I really like it. And I love the mantra. I love the mantra we do. Om Muni Muni, Maha Muni, Shakyamuni, Swaha. However, I'm afraid there is a bit of a problem. Because recently I realized that this idea of a silent sage clashes with my idea of the Buddha as a teacher. I mean, my image of a teacher is of someone talking to me, telling me things, you know. And the teachers I know in the order definitely aren't silent. You know, some of them are capable of going on and on indefinitely. They can keep it up, you know. And I've been wondering, therefore, what the Buddha could actually have been like as a person if he really was so silent. How was it that he came to teach so very extensively and so effectively? It's obvious that he did speak at times, and sometimes at length. He was quite capable of that, but he only did so, apparently, when he was sure it was appropriate. I think that's the point. I think his teaching came out of silence, emerged from silence, and it would have been a deep, meaningful silence. The Buddha didn't feel a constant need to express himself. When he did decide to speak, what struck you was that he was amazingly at peace in himself. You could tell, you know, something had happened inside him, and that something had given him a special kind of strength. And it seemed nothing could disturb that calm. You couldn't wind him up. You couldn't make him angry. You couldn't seduce him. You couldn't disappoint him. You couldn't humiliate him. And that wasn't because the Buddha was avoiding emotions like that. And he wasn't hiding them or covering them up. I think everybody who encountered him could see that any condition that would normally trigger emotions like that had just disappeared. This was a man who'd seen right through samsara. You know, there he was, right in front of you, sitting on the other shore of nirvana, and totally at his ease with that. And naturally, all that came across in his way of communicating. And in those days, it really was a case of what you see, you get. I mean, you could see immediately from his face where the Buddha's teaching was going to take you who were listening to him. If you took it on to practice his teaching, you could just see where it was going to be going. So what did you see? What was it that came across from the Buddha? Apparently, when he taught, there wasn't any edge of irritation like you do sometimes get. When the teacher's very intelligent, you know, as they sometimes are, you know, the teacher like that is very aware that he or she is going to be misunderstood. But even though he or she is always telling people not to misunderstand, they still go and do it, because people are people, and he has to explain it all over again. And some teachers
clearly find that rather painful, but it wasn't an issue for the Buddha at all. Also, there wasn't any of that edge of anxiety you can pick up when a Dharma teacher is rather too keen that you like them. You know, the Buddha clearly didn't feel any need for you to like or dislike what he said. He could tell how you were taking it, as you can, but he just left you free to understand it your way. He didn't feel a need to push his point. You know, you probably got the point, but then if you didn't, he didn't get upset, didn't get irritated. Basically, the Buddha never bothered about non-existent problems. People called the Buddha moderate, and that's how he was. You know, you didn't feel he regarded you as an inferior person. You know, you didn't feel he was looking down on you. He didn't pretend he saw you as superior to him either. You know, no false humility like you do sometimes get. But then he didn't have that attitude like, you know, we're both of us on the same level here. He didn't have that attitude either. You know, in your head, listening to him, there might be some kind of assessment or comparison going on, but not in his. So as I say, he was completely at peace. So when you met the Buddha, right in front of you was an example of what you could create through your practice, a creative and imperturbable mind. The mind that later was symbolized by the deep blue Buddha, Akshobhya, the Buddha who touches the earth, who calls the earth goddess to witness. And the Buddha had to do that one day himself when Mara, the evil one, challenged him to justify himself. You know, Mara's that impulse you sometimes get, that destructive impulse. You might be familiar with it. It's the impulse to fail. The impulse to... It's a negative, undermining voice. A sort of unsatisfiable, ever-questioning mind. And the Mara in Buddha's mind said, hey, get you. You know, get you, sitting all there alone in the woods. What makes you so sure a punk like you can get enlightenment? You know, what kind of a hippie are you, sitting there with your long hair? What do you know? Who do you think you are? What makes you so special? What makes you feel that you're so special? And the voice went on in his head. But it didn't undermine the Buddha. He knew about it. He knew that voice. And with that voice, he was totally unflustered, unruffled, unflappable, imperturbable. You know, he remembered all the practice he'd done. He remembered all the meditation, all the reflection that he'd done in the great forest, in the wide forest with its great hills and valleys. You know, he knew that the whole of nature had been witness to his efforts. So as he touched the earth, he was there touching the earth. Apparently the earth goddess herself came out of the ground right there, and whether this was in his imagination or whether she just emerged, you know, beautiful out of the ground in some way. And she just giggled, you know, just giggled at Mara and said, you know, what a silly man. What a silly man. And Mara, at that point, just felt horribly exposed, as you do when people say that to you. And he just ran away. He just ran away. He couldn't get out of there quickly enough. And everyone could see He'd just been trying to confuse Mara. He'd just been trying to confuse the Buddha. And clearly, it had been a silly thing to do. That quality of imperturbability, the anenja, it's a phrase that's used in the Pali to describe the deepest possible jhana, or integration of mind. It's the fundamental way we all practice the Buddha's teaching, and in that way, we're all becoming like that aspect of the Buddha. And we're all practicing to integrate our individuality, to bring our energies together, bring it all sort of on stream for the awakening that's happening within us. And the Buddha used to explain this as like folding different energies into a mixture. You know, you probably know, his usual example was mixing soap suds. But they probably still do this in India, but we just don't do this in the West. We don't make soap suds. So I think a more familiar image, which I like, is kneading dough. You know, making bread. You have to keep folding the dough into itself again and again. And you have to do it for a good long time, you know, like 10 whole minutes. Some of you must have done this. You know, it's quite hard work. You know, you squash it up with your hands and then you double it up and you press it together so that, you know, every single particle of flour, water, yeast and salt, it's all been pressed into every other particle somehow. And after a while, there's a change in the texture. The texture changes and the gluten starts coming out and the dough ball becomes sort of elastic and pliable in a completely new way. It's like it's a different substance somehow. And it's just the same with your mind. You know, the dough ball of your mind, if you like, which it's like that, isn't it, sometimes? You know, and in mindfulness of breathing practice, you keep folding into one another the various ingredients of the dough ball of your experience. You know, there's the in-breath, the out-breath, there's how you're feeling, there's the various thoughts that are occurring to you, there's the various impulses to do things and not do things. There's all the sounds, all the sights coming into your attention. And there's the physical sensations in your body. And you use the ongoing touch of the breath as a kind of a container for all this. And you fold it all in. You mix it and you mix it and you mix it over 40 minutes or so. So that as you persist over time, and it's not easy work, you know, there eventually comes a subtle change, and it does start feeling different. It does become more of a piece, becomes more elastic, more pliable, and it gets lighter. And then it's so much easier to direct the mind. So that's when we get what we call upachara samadhi, the first beginnings of jhana, or integrated mind. And from there, you're on your way, as it were, to the imperturbable, to the anenja, samadhi. And that process of integration is where the whole Buddhist path comes from. You know, as you could see in the Buddha. It was the first thing you noticed, that quality. He really was unflappable. You know, his whole manner encouraged you to pick up that quality from him and develop what he called sati sampajanya, mindfulness and clear comprehension. And this is what nowadays we call more simply just mindfulness. And he described that as the direct way you cultivate the awakening he had experienced. And he'd done it himself by experimenting on himself. Over the years, he's made quite a few mistakes, and he got stuck at quite a few blind alleys. But now he really found the way. And over his long life, he developed amazing skills in teaching it to all kinds of people. And his way basically came down to cultivating receptivity, a spiritual receptivity, and bringing that receptivity into all experience, into your body experience, into the feelings that you are having, into your emotional reactions, into your moods, and indeed into every tiny shift of experience, moment by moment. Now, receptive to what is really going on and assessing what exactly you are doing here. You know, asking, is this action helpful? Is this thought helpful? Is this impulse helpful? Is this action, is it wise? Or is it not wise? And doing it, doing all that entails being awake and willing to look at things freshly, with genuine curiosity. So there's this deepening view of reality. And this was cultivated throughout all the many Dharma teachings that the Buddha originated, such as reflection on the hindrances, the skandhas, and the noble truths. So the first petal of the flower of the Dharma that young hippie, Shakyamuni, offered to the world, you know, after his awakening, and then cultivated that over his long lifetime. I think it was like a psychedelic multicolored flower with four petals. And this first petal is an incredible blue. It's an incredible blue color. And it's at the east. You know, and there's also a yellow petal in the south. There's a red petal in the west. And there's a green petal in the north, and at the center is white. And of course, this is very similar to the Indo-Tibetan symbol of a mandala, the very same ancient Indo-Tibetan style mandala that's in the title of my talk. But hey, this is Europe, and we're now in the year 2012, so I think let's dare to be different and imagine today that it's a sunny day, and we're like bees, like honeybees, and that we're, as it were, captivated by the fragrance that's coming from this beautiful flower, the flower of the Dharma. You can imagine that. The flower that the young, newly enlightened Shakyamuni Buddha is offering. You know, I think this is an appropriately outdoor, natural world style of metaphor for this gathering. You have to use extra imagination on a day like this, but it's there. So, just returning to the Buddha, the imperturbable one. Yeah, he was good at paying attention. He was all there, as they say. But that wasn't all. You know, he had a lot of feeling as well. You know, he cared what was going on with you. And he could imagine what that might be, just as we can, you know. You know, in other words, the newly awakened Buddha had empathy. And this is the next stage on in everyone's development. In our Triratna way of understanding spiritual practice, this is sometimes called the stage of positive emotion. But then, these words, you know, positive emotion, on its own, this phrase doesn't really capture the richness of this realm. So here it's good to call up the archetypal image of Ratnasambhava, the Buddha, the golden yellow Buddha, who embodies warm, generous, compassionate feeling for all beings. You know, be as imperturbable as you like, but sooner or later you're going to need to acknowledge that the world consists of other people, and that even you, in many ways, are a stranger to yourself. If only you can meet the reality of other people, the path soon becomes a broader way of imagination and empathy. It's not just that single-minded focus on nirvana. That's also important, but it's not just that. Or put it another way, you realize more clearly what nirvana is really about. Nirvana is a radical seeing of the real nature of the reality we all live in, and that nature actually is the nature of living beings. The wisdom of nirvana is inseparable from the feeling of love and compassion. So we need to learn genuinely to love others and to really understand their suffering in a personal way, and to vibrate with other people's hopes, fears, pleasures, and pains. And of course, all this can come out of our practice of metta-bhavana. But there's many different ways to practice in relation to other people and the whole environment of other beings. Just for obvious example, there's our behavior. You know, our behavior is always in relationship to others. You can't help being an influence on others. Even if you stay up in your room all the time and never see anybody, they know about it. You know, just as we are all hugely influenced by other people. So to manage that, in Buddhism we have ethical principles. We have the precept of being more helpful, more generous, more content, more truthful, and more mindful. You know, our communication can also be kinder, more aware of other people. And it's all behavior in relation to others. All of it depends on a loving mind that is interested in others and is aware of others. When you start thinking about what's involved in empathy, in the end you see that Shakyamuni's golden petal contains everything that goes on in our Buddhist centers, retreat centers, local groups. It's everything you get from Dharma study. It's personal inquiry and questioning. It's hearing about the detail of the Dharma, discussing what the detail means, and wondering where this is really going, wondering whether this is really helpful, sorting all that out. It's learning about the ultimate nature of the reality we're all living in. It's the radical understandings Buddhism has of the nature of people, of us. And all of this material is very, very profound. And the goal, if you like, is in coming to terms with all that. Studying topics like the bodhicitta and the six perfections of the bodhisattva. There's just so much rich content in the Dharma to take in and digest, you know, into the body of our practice. And this stage, which, for want of a better word, or a better phrase, we call positive emotion, it engages our energy for years. As we get involved with the Dharma, with our particular Buddhist tradition, and sooner or later we learn about the wisdom teachings of Buddhism, like the Heart Sutra, and sooner or later do meditation on those deep teachings, those wisdom teachings. Reflect perhaps on the impermanence of each moment, of each experience that you're having. And such reflection might be very illuminating, might even open out your understanding in ways that otherwise would be unguessable. And it's when that more insightful meditation starts to bite that you find you've landed on that deep red petal in the west. And the deep red petal, we're still in the flower, right? The deep red petal is the petal of insight. It's the area of our spiritual lives called spiritual death. It's the realm of the Red Lord, Amitabha. It's the Buddha of the Western, who's at the Western horizon. The Buddha of infinite light, of insight into reality. And once your little bee has smelt the perfume and tasted the nectar in Amitabha's realm, which we seem to be playing on this theme quite a bit, it's Sukhavati, the Sukhavati, a land of bliss in which you can see everything. There's an unforgettable fragrance, and that perfumes everything else you do. That becomes the overarching quality of the whole of the rest of the spiritual path. None of these terms, none of these phrases like spiritual death can be really satisfactory. Just as we found with the idea of integration and the idea of positive emotion, there's so much more to them. And in traditional terminology, the red realm is that of vipassana, or direct seeing. Not vipassana meditation so much as the realization, the actual breakthrough, the direct seeing that comes about as a result of vipassana meditation. You've already opened yourself to the truth of things. You know, before you were reflecting on the idea of the truth, maybe through some study of the wisdom teachings. Maybe you were using the Heart Sutra as something to reflect on. You know, and you did some of that reflection in meditation, in a state of deep integration and strongly felt positive emotion. That's vipassana reflection. That involves subtle thinking. Now comes the point where you start to penetrate right into it and really see its truth. So it's no longer a thought about the truth. The truth itself breaks through the shell of your thought. And it's as though the truth itself is something that has its own life, if you like, has its own, it's a living thing. And what it is you're penetrating into is not something outside yourself. It is yourself, or rather it's your idea of yourself that is penetrated. More than that, it's your whole range of assumptions about what it is to be you, what the world around you is, and what it is for you to be alive. All that is seen. It's seen through in a particular way. It's as though each of us normally walls ourselves off from reality with our fixed ideas about what it is. And that's quite natural. We've all come through this life. We've all come into this life through the womb of our mother. And we've all grown up within the world, and we've grown up in the world that our mother found herself in. And in that long process, we've accumulated all kinds of ideas about what life is, about what our existence is. And what the Buddha did, he really homed in on the existential assumptions that everybody has. And the heart of the Buddha's teaching was in understanding and exposing those assumptions. You know, I was speaking just now about his way of relating to people. I was, you know, his incredible ability to empathize. And that was one quality. But he also had this ability to grasp the essence, to really get the point, really get the crucial point. And it was something he applied to everything. He applied it to him, to life. He applied it to other people. He applied it to himself. We all have this feeling of selfhood, of being me. And so did he. You know, we all have a sense of self. I mean, we have to. It's something, it's important, for example, when we're growing up, you know. But as we do start growing up, we soon realize, even as small children, to some extent, at least in small ways, that it can be more fun to give up the way we're identifying with ourselves. I mean, we find it's better overall to be generous, to be less selfish. Now, spiritual life in many ways is an extension of growing up. You could call it growing up for adults. You know, with Dharma practice, we start taking on board those deep existential issues that are so much bigger than we are, like the reality of death and the reality of birth, of our deep-seated delusion. And contacting what's bigger than we are really helps put in perspective this thing we call myself. The basic delusion is not feeling like myself, which is just normal, but the feeling that there really are substantial, unchanging things, and that we ourselves are something substantial and unchanging. That's the basic delusion. It's not hard to understand intellectually that we're not unchanging. You know, it's as plain as the nose on your face, in a way. You know, and we know it. If you need more persuasion, you know it from science, you know. There's nothing that doesn't change. However, all the intellectual understanding in the world doesn't necessarily change how people behave. Strangely, they still behave quite selfishly. So we need to see in experience how tricky are the ways that we personally cling to our particular kinds of idea of me. We really are experts at concealing ego, especially from ourselves. So we tend not to notice. I certainly don't, you know. But if you can, if you really want to, you can see it. And that's the point. It comes down to the willingness to look and the willingness to change. It comes down to spiritual receptivity. And typical of this stage of spiritual experience is a sense of collapse. It's an experience of a bubble popping. It's an experience of something that's been inflated, deflating. It's rather like one of those old balloons that was left lying around a week after Christmas or a week after the birthday party. There are still some balloons that you discover under the sofa or something like that, and they're rather old and they've gone a bit soft, and they don't actually pop, you know, they don't actually pop, they just make a sort of farting sound, and they just deflate in rather a comic, pathetic way. And that's just what happens to our very particular sense of who we are. There are times when it just collapses. It's not the experience we might expect to occur right at the apex, right at the culmination of the Buddhist spiritual path. We expect that to be rather wonderful. But that is it. You know, that is spiritual death, the death of ego, you know, the death of hubris, of pride, of the sense of being superior or of being inferior, the same, or the sense of being equal to others, it's the same. It's the collapse that makes room for something more real. The collapse that reveals the amazing nature of things, the amazing nature of life and death. That, and the liberation and the change that comes out of that is profound. And it's profound in ways that are much less easy to explain. And this is where we start buzzing again. As Dharma bees, I hope you're getting on with this metaphor. As Dharma bees, we find ourselves grazing, if bees can be said to graze, I'm not quite sure what the term is, amidst that mysterious green petal at the north of the Dharma flower that Shakyamuni is still offering us. So what is going on there? After that collapse, after the experience of insight, if you like, well, maybe it can be explained easiest if we remember that this liberation, this vimoksha, it's called, it happens after the realization of non-self. And it's a result of that profound opening. There's been a glimpse that our experience is actually empty of self, and always has been. You know, it's seen never ever to have existed as such. So what an awakening that is. You know, it's never ever been like that. We know now for sure that actually there are no solid reference points anywhere. This is quite a thing. We may not understand it, but we trust its truth because we've seen it for ourselves. And we can, having done that, we can let go. We can let go with confidence, freely and joyfully, into an experience of what we call something like universal shunyata, the emptiness of all conditioned reference points, like self and other. And where there is no longer any real distinction between self and other, it naturally appears that spiritual transformation is coming from outside us. It's coming from everything we encounter. And when Sangharakshita refers to the Dharma Niyama, the special conditioning factor of the awakening mind, that's what he's talking about. You know, as the mind is progressively freed from the grip of cyclic conditioning factors, something amazing and new comes out of that. Our practice frees us from dependence on the negative conditioning of karma, volitional action, because our karmas have become entirely skillful. And this quality of freedom and liberation that comes from beyond you, beyond the little conditioned you, this is the quality, let's call it, of Amoghasiddhi, the dark green Buddha of the northern realm. And the Buddha himself, the historical Shakyamuni, he had this experience as well. He didn't know where his awakening had come from. You know, it hadn't come from him. The idea of himself no longer made much sense, no longer made literal sense. Yet he felt a deep, heartfelt gratitude for what had happened, and he wanted to express that. But to whom? When he discovered the way completely independently, completely alone. He thought of expressing it to the previous Buddhas. He thought of expressing it to the Dharma itself, somehow, you know. After all, though he'd discovered the Dharma, it was as though the Dharma had just come to him. And in the end, that was too abstract. And he just gave thanks by worshipping the great tree, the tree of awakening that had sheltered him on the night of his liberation. And it was a month or so later, when Shakyamuni had become a bit more accustomed to being the awakened one, and finally decided he could communicate the way to his awakening, it was then that he offered this amazing flower that is now on offer. And, you know, a flower with power, you could say. You know, with four coloured petals. You know, how attractive can I make this thing seem? You know, four-coloured petal with a radiant white centre. And I haven't really told you yet. I haven't told you that this Dharma flower has a remarkable centre. It has a central disc like a sunflower or a daisy. And it is a flat disc that actually is a composite flower in itself. And this composite flower is made up of hundreds of miniature florets, each of which has short petals. You could check it out. Next time it's a pleasure to sit on the grass, have a look at a daisy, you know. Have a close look. Each of those hundreds of tiny florets in the centre, it's got its own stamen, its own pistil, and they're crowded together, and this whole mass, it forms a landing field that is attractive to bees. And in that same way, the Dharma flower is designed to be irresistible, to make sure lots of fertilisation goes on, and the Dharma gets widely disseminated. I hope that image is all right. And the central landing part of the flower, of course, represents, and I should have explained this before, the open attitude of that I mentioned before, of curiosity and imagination that I described as being at the heart of the mindfulness practice. That spiritual receptivity. We cultivate openness to the truth, through simply sitting mindfully. Without doing anything, but just being very receptive to everything that happens. In other words, through the just sitting meditation. So with that, I'm going to finish by offering that Dharma flower Shakyamuni is offering. It's for you, basically. You know, you can enjoy it as a flower of meditation with mindfulness, with spiritual receptivity at its heart. And the blue petal that blossoms next to that heart, that of integration, is all about the joys of anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. Then the yellow petal of positive emotion is characterized by metta bhavana and every rich development and progress in our Dharma practice. And then next, in a way that's never expected, never guessed, you get blossoming that scarlet petal, that red petal of vipassana or insight, spiritual illumination, and spiritual death. That's also a petal. And then you notice that, how strangely, that the green petal of spiritual rebirth has fully emerged, and along with it, there's a mysterious image of the Buddha. An image that displays what all these qualities look like in real life, which is the whole point of having the Buddha image. And suddenly, you smell the incredible perfume. And that's when you wake up. That's it.
Great, thank you very much, Kamalasila. Good talk. It's just really helpful to have a map. I think people find it really helpful to have a map of the spiritual life and to see how all the different teachings and practices that we do relate to each other, how they kind of link up together, how they follow on from each other. So in a way, I think there was a lot in that talk, actually. I think it was quite a dense talk, a lot in it, because Kamalasila was laying out the whole map of the spiritual life. And then he was colouring in the map. There was lots of colours He was filling out the map with lots of detail and imagery. And then he changed the map into an image of a lotus with these beautiful different coloured flowers, and us as the Dharma bees buzzing happily around the lotus. So just a lovely, lovely image and rich image to go away and think about and reflect on. So thank you very much, Kamala Shila.